time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 17th of August 2013. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua. On Saturday the 17th of August, Sharon Brown talked to David Basham about mental health, Alex Stone about the Marine Reserve proposal. She talked with Waiheke High School Board Chair John Stansfield about the search for a new principal for the school, Jacqueline Taylor on the GCSB bill, and Megan and Mary Alatini about a Kavanagh Jade Trust fundraiser.
Right, David, good morning.
Good morning.
See, he's still smiley.
I'm male. I'm used to taking the blame.
All right. Okay. Well, that's all good then. Line them up. Great. Good. So, yes, tell us.
Yeah. Well, I actually, this book's not brand new, but it was given to me. And I thought, oh, I'll give it away and I'll talk about it on air. John Kirwan, the well-known All Black. Although I have to admit you didn't know who he was, but maybe you're not really into All Blacks.
No, I'm not into rugby at all. Well, but I did know his face, I just didn't know his name.
Right. So, this is a book that he wrote about his life, not as an All Black, but his life with depression and anxiety. And it's called All Blacks Don't Cry, A Story of Hope, where he goes through what happened to him. Little did people know... Yeah, we can now see each other, can't we? Little did people know that he suffered crushing anxiety attacks on the football field, which is not what they expect All Blacks to do. And in fact, he almost ran off the field once. It was so bad. So it's not a book that's going to win the Pulitzer Prize or anything, but it's written for the audience. I think it does a good job. Each chapter has an introduction from people he played football with or he knew, talking about how they didn't know about how he was, how he got over it. He's a great one for believing in hope. To the point, I've actually got hope tattooed on my arm. I took it really seriously. And
is that inspired by him or just in general?
Yeah, no, just in general. Right. And by him as well, because I thought, you know, it's something that if you do suffer from depression and anxiety, and it's fairly well known that I do, hope's got to be it. This, and a lot of in this is comments like, this too will pass. You know, that belief that this, I'll get through this and get over it, and how he handled everything and what he did. So it's a really good book to read if you know someone who's suffering from depression or you're suffering from it yourself. It gives you some hope, gives you some inspiration to do it. And if somebody would like to get in touch with me, I can give them this book. And one of the things, of course, that John Kirwan did is he got a knighthood for his contribution to mental health, and that was quite a bit to do with fronting a e-therapy program called The Journal.
And we talked a bit about
actually,
that last time,
actually,
didn't we?
Actually like a journal. So if somebody would like to... text me, I'll give them my cell phone number, so that'll be, you'll need to repeat this sometime today, 027-478-1969, 027-478-1969, and if you can tell me what e-therapy program he fronts, that can't be hard, and your name and address, or just your address, I'll drop it in your letterbox. And you'll have a copy of All Blacks Don't Cry, A Story of Hope.
Lovely. And we're assuming you're listening from Waiheke when he says he's going to drop it in your letterbox.
Oh, yes, we need to do that.
He's not planning a trip to France anytime soon.
No, I'm not planning to go to New Plymouth or Tauranga or anywhere. Right. But, I mean, if the station would pay for it, I'd go. Yes.
Lovely. Yeah. Great. Good. So the fact that it's written by an... Are you a rugby fan yourself?
Not really.
Right. But the fact that it's written by a man who seems quite sort of manly, and is an All Black, which even if you're not into rugby, you can still look up to. Mm. Is that an important part of why you enjoy the book or it's accessible?
I think it. Yeah, I think it, It is, because it's unexpected. You don't. I mean, I wasn't brought up to worship all blacks. In fact, I played football, or soccer, as they call it in New Zealand. You don't expect, I don't think, an all black to come out and say, "I suffered from terrible depression. I suffered from anxiety. I nearly ran off the football field. I really didn't know what to do that day. I came back from a tour to South Africa, crushed by anxiety." You don't expect that. And so that's where had the big impact. That's where he's made the big impact. And I think, yeah, it was so valuable to mental health. He has made such a difference. And that's how he got his knighthood. And he just, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a great one for knighthoods, but hey, he didn't make it for making lots of money. He made it because he really did say, "Hey, I've got it. You can get over it. I got over it. This is how I did it. And, you know, you can do it too."
Lovely.
And
so the book's a little bit of a how-to get over it as well?
Yeah, it talks about how he did
strategies,
it.
Strategies, yeah.
But it's not a therapy book. But
it's an inspiration.
Yeah. And the book's got, at the end, is question and answers from a clinical psychologist. So there's a few things in there. But it's not a clinical book.
No.
It's easily readable.
Read.
Yeah, it is a good little
read.
And
it might also be good for people who don't necessarily have depression themselves, but, or don't know they have it, but that know other people that do, some sort of insight into what's going on for them.
And a lot of people, I had somebody ask me, you know, what's it like to have depression? Or what's it like to have anxiety? And I explained, and they went, didn't realise it was like that. And so this will be a good way of sort of finding out what maybe a friend's going through. Because he says your friends and family are the ones that get you through.
Right.
If they understand, you can do it. And I know that too. Some of my friends have just been fantastic.
Mm.
Or all of my friends have been fantastic, and my family too. Mm. So it's been a big difference.
Oh, right. Okay. Mm. Great. Lovely. So that's the book.
Yep.
So All Blacks Don't Cry, that David's giving away.
Yes.
And what was the other thing you wanted to talk
about?
Well,
there'd been some research come out just the other week by Dr. Vanessa Green, who's head of Victoria University down in Wellington, the School of Educational Psychology. And she surveyed something like 600 people through schools, teachers and senior people through schools in New Zealand, to look at bullying. And it's sort of like, the research shows that bullying's sort of like an accepted part of life, which it isn't and doesn't have to be. And some really interesting statistics that came out of it. 40% of those surveyed had heard someone being verbally bullied the week before. 68% believe that bullying starts at preschool. And there's an article was in the Herald recently that two-year-olds are into bullying. 57% believe that cyberbullying is mainly conducted by girls. 46% believe that cyberbullying is conducted by people between 11 to 14. And 61% agree that teachers should help students deal with cyberbullying outside of school. I'm not sure about that one. I think teachers have to do everything. And I think that sort of goes, oh, well, I'm a parent, I don't have to do it. And I think parents have got a big role on that, and not say, oh, teachers have to do it. But at school, it is very, very important. So that's the research that's come out. And you can read about that on the Mental Health Foundation website.
Mm.
But rather than just say, here's the evidence, isn't it awful, I've got some sites that I've researched, one for children, one for adults, one about cyberbullying, people being bullied over cell phones. So I'm going to put those on Out of the Blue on Waiheke Radio. That's the Out of the Blue's Facebook page, and people can follow it there. So there is some things you can do.
Lovely. So that's Out of the Blue Waiheke Radio.
On Waiheke Radio, and that's Facebook the Facebook site. Page.
Mm.
And there is another Facebook page called Pink Shirt Day.
Oh, okay.
And Pink Shirt Day is the Facebook page set up by the Mental Health Foundation. And I think next week I'll talk a lot about the Mental Health Foundation and let people know it's a great source of... It doesn't provide counselling, but it provides enormous amounts of information. Because bullying's far more prevalent than what people realise.
Mm.
And you don't tell anyone.
Mm. I always think things like that are also a mark of... how happy people are generally. I don't know. It seems to me that people are getting more bullied at work or in other contexts that they then take back to their families and then model for their children. And it's a little bit of it is how do you break that cycle of, you know, having a go at people who are perceived as weaker?
Yeah, and I think that's what happens. I mean, I know I was bullied at school when I was young because I was – very anxious. I was very timid. And I just didn't really take part in things because I was too scared, too shy. I had a stutter. You know, I had it sort of a few knocks against myself. And I remember the day it all changed. And I was thinking about this the other day and I thought I must talk about it. It's fun. I was watching the people, some of the people who bullied me were playing cricket and I was watching them. I don't know why. I mean, probably keep your enemies closer or something. And I'm watching them, and they said, would you like to bowl? And I think it was probably done to sort of make me look a bit stupid. But what they didn't know is that the next-door neighbour and I used to practice bowling in the backyard. So the first bowl, I bowled the captain out. The second one, I bowled somebody out, and it stopped. I was in the cricket team. So I'm not saying that's the answer, but they picked on me because they thought that I was weaker, and they could do it, and that's what it's about. And it's very hard because I never told my parents about it. You don't go home and say you've got it.
Well, it's also hard to put your finger on not being a part of the crowd.
Mm. Yeah.
And really, it's also hard the other way. You know, like my children are in Fiji and I speak to my son and he goes, oh, I've got no friends. And I'm thinking, well, has he really got no friends or is he just saying that to, you know, wind me up a bit? Or is there something that's happening to him at school that he feels he's got no friends? Is it something that's coming from his side because he's in a whole crowd of new kids that he doesn't know, so he doesn't know how to break in? And they're not the same as his mates here that he's known forever. And, yeah, so
yeah,
it's really hard.
It really is complicated. Yeah. And it must be very hard for parents who've got an idea and the child isn't telling them.
Mm.
But there's some good sites, and I found some. I'll put those on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
This thing about adult bullying, I'll put that on there. Because I've worked for a boss who was a bully.
Mm.
And, you know, it was really quite hard. At times I got in between her and the staff.
Mm.
Because I used to stand up to her and I didn't really, I felt quite proud of myself really because she was a terror. But that can be very, very hard and that can make life, people don't want to go to work. It makes it very, very hard indeed. So I'll put that on the Facebook
page. I think there should be something more on creating positive work environments. Because people seem to project a lot of their unhappiness onto their work situation.
Well, we spend a lot of time at work. When you look how much time... See, my view is a lot of people say, oh, well, they're paid, so that's fine. But I look at it quite differently with the Wish Trust. They still come in. They might come in on a bad day. They might come in when someone's not well in the family. They've had something go wrong. They may have some... They still come in and do it. And I remember the first day I was 7 years ago when I was appointed the manager. On my first day, I went to say hi, and they went, what do you want? And I said, I just want to say thank you. And they looked at me like, and I still thank them every day. I thank everybody I see for what they did because they come in and do it. You know, there's more to it than money. They come in sometimes when they're not feeling right, when they've got issues at home or anything. And the good thing about working in mental health is we can actually share those and actually help people.
Mm.
So it's a pretty good environment. But, you know, I thank the people every day because they're coming in. It's not just them, you know, you can't just go, they're being paid for it.
Mm. Mm.
Unlike us, of course, who do this all for nothing.
Yeah. And bully each other on the radio.
Yeah.
um, And just to the talk to the cyberbullying, there's a really good initiative at Te Huruhi. I don't know if it's at other schools as well, but they have a sort of a closed Facebook type mechanism where the teachers can get in and supervise, but the kids have that kind of space that they can communicate with other kids in the school. And I think it's a really good thing because it teaches them how to engage with each other online in a positive way, and at the same time the teachers can direct them to better ways of interacting if they're not particularly nice.
Yeah, because for me, I wasn't brought up with cell phones or email mm-hmm. or anything, and I do discover that bad news is usually conveyed by email.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
good
yeah.
news is done face to face. Email is email. The bad news comes by email.
Oh,
and
right.
I always think emails are five. Oh, I still struggle with it as a means of communication with people because it's so easy to say things that you perhaps may think twice about it. I remember a boss saying to me, whenever you write a letter, this shows you how old I am, it was the truth. That was a scandalous paper. He said, every time you write a letter, think, will this end up in truth? And I've kept that. When I write an email, I think, and I know truth doesn't exist, and I'm glad it didn't because it was a shocking rag. But it was very popular. And even today, I think, this email's going out. Would I want that in truth with my name on it? So, you know, that's a good thing to think. Would I really want this published?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if the answer's no, well, don't send it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good, wise advice. Good. And have we got anything else that you wanted to talk about?
That's a lot. That's my cell phone number for Waiheke people.
Lovely.
0274781969, and all you need to do is tell me the e-therapy program that John Kirwan's on and just give me your address and I'll drop it in your letterbox, and I'll also put that on the Facebook page. I'll do that today.
Lovely. Great. Good. Wakey Radio. Well, back again, Island Life, and Alex Stone has come to talk about the Marine Reserve proposal. Great. So, Alex, this has been all over the news. It's in the Gulf News. There are some ads in the paper taken out by the Keep Our Beaches group. So I think this is what we're going to look at today is just what the Marine Reserve proposal is. And then perhaps you could address yes. some of the concerns that people have raised over yeah. the last month or so. What do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Sharon. Thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, the Marine Reserve, we're calling it an initiative because proposal is gets people a bit concerned. It's an initiative to establish another marine reserve on the northern side of Waiheke Island, somewhere along the northern coastline. The background to it is our group was formed, a little volunteer group. We were formed after we read the 2011 State of the Hauraki Gulf Report, which reported ongoing environmental decline across all considerations, everything, whether it's seabirds, marine mammals, everything was in decline across the Gulf generally. And the report ended up with a very bold statement by scientists. For them to say things like this is very bold. They said, "And if we want to do something to improve the state of the Gulf, bold, innovative, and sustained things have to be done. So the status quo is basically not an option." So our little community group thought, well, we live on this island. We're the biggest single community that's living entirely surrounded by the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park. We thought it would be good for us to take the lead. And we thought the best way to work towards greater biodiversity in the Gulf is to propose or have an initiative going to establish another marine reserve. The rationale behind that is very strong. The science behind it, shall we say, is compelling and irrefutable. We need more marine reserves in the Gulf, and that's just the bottom line. At the moment,
so what does a marine reserve actually do?
A marine reserve is a place where you can't take fish or shellfish. But apart from that, you can swim, you can do underwater ballet, you can do boating, kayaking, scuba diving, you can anchor a boat, you can launch a boat, you can do everything but taking fish or shellfish. Yeah.
Right. And why, and what do they actually do for the sea?
Marine reserves are basically a guarantee. Just like on land, we all recognize the value of parks or national parks. It's the same in the sea. The interesting comparison, if we often compare things to land-based conservation efforts. In New Zealand, 30% of New Zealand land area is under some kind of conservation protection. In the sea, it's quite the opposite. In the Hauraki Gulf, 0.3% is in marine reserve at the moment. So 99.7% of the Hauraki Gulf is available for extractive industries and recreational fishing.
Yeah. Right, and so it's that the scientists are saying is damaging to the ecosystem.
Scientists say that at the very least, 10% of the Gulf needs to be in marine reserve. There are three levels. If you want a marine reserve, if you want a network, you need to have them spread around the place, obviously. If you want a network of marine reserves to work for, in terms of education, recreation, and science research, it needs to, the network needs to cover at least 10% of the area. Mm. If you'd like the marine reserve network to work in terms of securing biodiversity, it needs to be at least 20% of the area. And if you'd like the marine reserve network to have maximum benefit for fisheries, both recreational and commercial, that network needs to cover 30% of the area. Right. So think of where we're at right now. Right now we've got 0.3%. And people promoting marine reserves are looking just for a little bit more space. And for this idea, which is irrefutable in terms of science and in terms of an ethical approach to future generations' needs, is kind of necessary. Yeah. Mm.
So
long answers. Eh?
No, that's all good. But you're moving from 0.3, and then how much of this would this cover, this area that you're talking
about?
Our
initiative?
Yeah.
Our initiative, it's hard to say, Shirin, because at the moment we have no lines on the map. Right now there are no lines on the map. I personally made a mistake a few months ago being a bit over-enthusiastic, and I did scribble some lines on the map. Big mistake. Because we want at the moment just to get through the principles behind it. So right now, as we stand, as I said to the community board on Thursday, there are no lines on the map. So I can't say how big the reserve would be.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because one of the big criticisms, or one of the big things that people are raising, is why is this marine reserve being, why are the lines on the map taking in two really important public beaches and public areas and places where there's lots of population? Mm. Why isn't it further down, like near Cactus Bay or past Donnytangy?
That's a good question. It's a good question. And I'm just got to reiterate, I made a mistake drawing the lines on the map. If I go back to our initiative is to be based on science, and we the scientists have advised us that to do a credible process of investigation, we need at least four surveys of different types. We've done the first survey, which is an underwater topography survey. We want to raise money for a biological survey, and after that will come a social science survey, obviously people's attitudes and so on, and then maybe an economic impact analysis. But the biggest part is the biological survey, which will cost tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah.
And where is survey on where? So are you doing that all along that coastline?
Yes,
round Waiheke or on those public beaches?
No. The survey area that we are a small group and can't afford to survey the entire Gulf. And because we're based on Waiheke and benefit from Waiheke, we thought it'd be good to have a marine reserve somewhere attached to Waiheke to balance the different ecosystem in the south. And so the survey area we've asked the scientists to look at is the entire northern coastline.
Right. Mm. So the entire northern coastline, some of it falls out of the boundaries that you've drawn on your map.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, in fact, those boundaries, just to clarify, because it's been a real bone of contention, yes, and I've been lost with it myself. Yeah. It's not necessarily those lines.
No, not at all.
No. Okay, and so you'd be quite prepared to move those lines somewhere along so that it's not in a public along a public beach area?
That's a possibility, definitely. It's just one of the tenets of science, and because we based this whole thing on science, one of the basic tenets of science is if you don't know what you don't know, you can't presume. So it's not for me to say, before the results of all these surveys have come in, exactly where it can or can't be.
Right.
But so it could be.
So part of this is a sort of quite a long process in the sense this might take another 5 years to get these different surveys or, you know, by the time you save the money to do it or not? Or?
Yeah, I think, Sharon, at this stage it's going to take more than 5 years because there's obviously quite vigorous opposition, and the average sort of time span for a marine reserve proposal in New Zealand is about 15 years.
Oh, really?
And I must admit, once again, I was a bit enthusiastic earlier. I thought we'd get it. I thought it was a no-brainer and we'd make much faster progress, but no, it'll take a long time, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. And so addressing some of these other concerns then, this notion of... So basically, do some of the other... I'm a bit confused now because I didn't understand that about the lines. Mm. But the concerns that have been raised have been around access to the ramp
at Sandy Bay. Yeah.
Which I mean, I'm not a boatie, but it seems to me that, you know, that is a really important access point for people getting into the water.
Yeah, okay.
So would that be affected? I mean, part of what you're saying is that it might not even include Sandy Bay.
It could be that. Sharon, in answering this question, I'll just have to give you a little sort of disclaimer in advance. Mm. With the Marine Reserve, we're talking about biodiversity across the Gulf for future generations. Getting down to the nitty-niggly stuff about parking at a boat ramp, I think is a complexity after the, you know, it's an argument that it's a debate that comes down the track a wee bit, and it's not directly related to improving biodiversity in the Gulf.
It's not.
Yeah. But I can answer the question.
Just because, you know, biodiversity, not biodiversity, if I was a boatie and that was the only access point I had on the northern side, I'd be really pissed off.
Sorry, I just have to correct you there, Sharon. You're not a boatie. I am. I've sailed all my life, and I've lived on Waiheke for 18 years, and I've sailed all around this coastline all that time, and I know full well what, you know, the launching and boating facilities are.
Right, so are there other launching?
Absolutely. Sandy Bay is not the only launching spot on the northern coast. You can launch at Matiatia, you can launch at the left-hand side of Onaroa Beach, you can launch at Sandy Bay, and you can launch at Onitangi Beach. You know the famous tractors at Onitangi Beach?
Yes.
That's what they're there for, to launch boats.
Right.
And Onitangi Beach, as we all know, is a vast expanse. Mm. And Onitangi, to be fair, Onitangi will be very difficult to launch in a northerly wind, but at least half of the time our prevailing wind is southwesterly, in which case Onitangi is pretty flat. The left-hand side of Onaroa Beach has got hundreds of meters of beach where you can launch, and for 15 or more years the dinghy sailing group from the local boating club has been launching boats there, and we've never not been able to launch the rescue boat. It's totally possible. So they're if you count them up on your fingers, there are about 8 or 10 launching spots along the northern coast. And so if your boat's very big and heavy and you need a big 4x4 and a trailer, there might be 6 launching spots. But beaches like Palm Beach or Little Onaroa, you can launch a hand-carried boat. If you can pick up your kayak or your tinny, you can launch at those beaches too. So there is a lot of space to launch boats around here. And another thing I could add is there's been a lot of surveys done about recreational fishing, and the average recreational fishing boat has a 60 horsepower motor. That's the average. Sure, there's some small tinnies with a 5 horsepower motor, but most of them are fairly reasonably sized, seaworthy boats with a 60 horsepower motor. A boat like that can plane at between 20 and 30 knots. So if you wanted to get to the northern side, you could launch at Kennedy Point or at Wharf Road in Ostend, which are very, very sheltered launching places. And a boat like that could get to the northern side within 20 minutes of motoring. So access to the water is possible, but I do concede that Sandy Bay can be a pinch point, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And then the other pinch, or the other issue that people have been mentioning, is this notion of Nudie Bay.
Yes, I'm sorry, I shouldn't take the objections frivolously, but I don't think that's an issue, really.
Right. The objection that's been raised to me is the fact that it's one of those things that's tolerated but not in law.
Exactly.
But yet there are lots of people who enjoy it.
That's fine.
And so people are worried that if you start mucking about with legal, you know, marine reserves and it covers that part of the bay, and of course it's a really beautiful bay, that people will want to come in there, do their snorkeling, and then they're going to be all appalled that there are some naked people.
I've had people say to me, you know, there'll be school tour groups at Nudie Bay, and I think that's a bit of a stretch. You know, no school teacher in his or her right mind would take their primary school kids to Nudie Bay. So the people that would come to Nudie Bay would be only from the seaward side, boat access. And if you go to Nudie Bay at any day during the summer, there are boats there now. You know, some weekends in the summer, it's full of boats. It doesn't seem to be a problem just yet. The other thing I should mention is that a marine reserve happens below mean high tide mark. And so the marine reserve is the bit under the water, not the beach. Not the beach above the high tide mark, yeah.
Right, so it wouldn't be covered by yeah, okay.
There is a little bit of a misunderstanding, perhaps, about where a marine reserve starts and stops. And you have to perhaps try compare similar situations. The majority of marine reserves in New Zealand adjoin Department of Conservation land for the historical fact that it was just easier to get them established in front of already land that was already protected. But where a marine reserve is in front of land that is owned in another way, but whether it's private ownership or city council ownership, the marine reserve stops below the high tide mark.
Yeah. Right, okay. Because the other issues around the dog walkers and the use of the beach area, that's been another.
Yeah, this one has been a bit of a concern to our campaign, because it's a significant part of the opposition, the negative campaign. I think it's the second biggest thing they highlight on their ads. And I'm afraid it's a little bit, there's a little bit of misinformation there. If you look at this week's Gulf News, it's quite interesting. On the very back page, I've got a wee rebuttal where I say 6 marine reserve beaches in New Zealand allow dogs. On the letters page, one of the negative campaigners has said, taking the sort of other view of arithmetic, there are 34 marine reserves in New Zealand, 28 don't allow dogs. So we agree, 6 marine reserves.
So basically, what we're saying is that the condition of being
a
marine reserve doesn't preclude the presence of dogs, and that could be something that's negotiated.
Absolutely,
into it,
unless the land on the sea, on the landward side is already dock land, because then the docks are already excluded. But if the land on the landward side is under different ownership, a community can make a plan. I should give some comparisons, and I can read the list of marine reserves where you're allowed to walk dogs. The first one is Long Bay at above Auckland. Dogs are allowed there. During daylight saving, dogs are allowed before 10 and after 6:30. Outside daylight saving, dogs are allowed all day. That sounds pretty much like what we've got here. Kapiti Marine Reserve, which is off the town of Paraparaumu. They have an interesting situation there. They drew the marine reserve boundary to angle off the main beach of the town, so it actually doesn't come ashore. But the marine reserve boundary comes ashore for 1 kilometre between Paraparaumu and the town of Waikanae. And on that 1 kilometre of coastline, it's around an estuary, so there are ducklings and things. And the local rules of the Kaipiti Coast District Council say you can walk dogs there on a lead.
But you can be selective about exactly where the marine reserve goes.
Yeah, you can.
So
potentially, a community can decide on the
excludes a beach.
Yeah, absolutely. You could exclude a beach. Yeah. Another one is Taputuranga Marine Reserve, which is in South Wellington. Most people know it as Island Bay, and there are 3 beaches there: there's Ophira Bay, Island Bay, and Houghton Bay. And if you Google the Wellington City Council dog walking info, you'll see that dogs are allowed at all times on one of the bays, and one of the other bays the dogs are restricted, you know, just like daylight saving kind of situation. And half of the beach is no dogs because it's a place where seals come ashore. So it looks like communities can make,
and those are marine reserves in quite highly, that Wellington one is quite highly populated, isn't
That's right, yeah. One of the elements of misinformation in the negative campaign is they stated quite strongly that marine reserves in front of built-up areas are unprecedented, and therefore this one must fail. There are about 6 or 7 marine reserves in New Zealand that are built in front of built-up areas. Once again, Long Bay, Kapiti, Pollen Island off Auckland, Sugarloaf Islands off New Plymouth is a marine protected area, but adjoining it, that's the front in front of New Plymouth City, but adjoining it, just where the suburbs of New Plymouth kind of peter out, is another is a proper marine reserve called Tapuai. Then there's Taputuranga off Island Bay and
so
Wellington,
there's quite a few,
and there's
basically.
One in Whangarei, in Australia there are half a dozen, and around the world there are many more.
Right,
so it is,
okay.
So it's not unprecedented.
But nonetheless, the opposition will come from people in built-up areas.
Yeah, sure.
And the Hauraki Gulf, there's only 0.03% of marine reserves.
That's right.
So why does it have to be on a built-up area at all? Could, you're saying that it could be built somewhere that's not populated, or maybe just has one house on the
absolutely
on
yeah
it.
But
so,
can
so
I just
why, so what would be the conditions under which that would happen, or is this just dependent on where the surveys come out that you're saying this will come out as the best place, or what are the factors that affect where that goes?
One of the most important elements to our initiative is we see the marine reserve as a wonderful intergenerational gift to the future children of Waiheke. And I was instrumental in the establishment of the Sea Sports Academy at the high school. And this is just an example. And over the years, the Sea Sports Academy has become very popular. There are about 30 students in it right now. And the underwater modules of the Sea Sports Academy have become the most popular. And I find it a bit odd that we need to take them to Groat Island, to show our sea sports students what a wonderful underwater marine environment looks like. We've got to truck them all the way up to Groat Island, or ship them all the way to Poor Knights. So also for primary school kids, we thought a marine reserve environment on our northern shore would be an extraordinary positive experiential learning classroom for the kids of Waiheke. So that's one of the good things about it. So if you made it extra remote, it would lose that distinct societal advantage.
That's part of the thinking. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. And I think it's really interesting that you just, I mean, I think what you're doing is a very brave thing.
Oh, yes,
because,
certainly is.
Because, you know, it is... Set, as you say, there are only 0.03% of the Hauraki Gulf that is marine reserve.
Yeah, that's right.
And with the pressure from farming and the pressure from, you know, fishing and the degradation of our marine environment, something obviously has to be done.
That's right. Yeah.
Is part of the issue around education and making people see the value of... a marine environment and the importance of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Because it
yeah.
seems to me that potentially if all the concerns are addressed, one could have, there's no reason to be so oppositional. One could
exactly,
have
yeah.
an environment that's really positive for everyone.
Yeah, I agree with you. The existing marine reserves have become tourist magnets. People are inspired when they visit them. They think they're the most wonderful places. And we're saying we could have a wonderful place here. Yeah. Mm.
So again, actually, that was the last concern that people have said, oh, we're going to be absolutely swamped. There are going to be thousands of tour buses. There's going to be, I don't know, I can't remember how many hundred thousand people are going to, tens of thousands of people are going to come.
Yeah.
So do you have any answer to that? Because I think that's another concern that people just want to, you know, relax a bit on Waiheke. And then the next thing they know, there's going to be like tour buses and ice cream stands everywhere.
No, it's a legitimate concern, sure, and it certainly is. I think the concerns are a little exaggerated in that the comparisons are made with Goat Island and Cathedral Cove on the Coromandel. And the comparisons are a little awkward in that Goat Island and Cathedral Cove are both on dock land, and both of them have very, very limited access to reach. Each of them has got a very small little beach, and each one has a single pathway basically leading down to the beach. I think the more relevant comparisons would be with Kapiti or the one in South Wellington, where you can see what you can see there isn't real overcrowding or all that issue. The other thing just to remember is that Waiheke itself is promoted quite vigorously internationally as a tourist destination. We know that Auckland City promotes it. It's just what happens. People are inspired to come and visit Waiheke, and if the marine environment is better, sure, there will be more people. But I think we should have the nous as a community to work out ways of managing that. The other point I can make is that it takes 10 to 15 years for a marine reserve to establish. Goat Island's been going for 50 years. So when you first establish a marine reserve, all it is a couple of yellow buoys in the water and a spot where people can't fish. You don't get crowds of people immediately because it takes a while for the marine life to recover. Mm. And in that 10 to 15 years, I would think our community could figure out ways to manage visitor load. Yeah. Mm. The visitor load, I think, is manageable. People have said, used the headland sculpture on the Gulf as an example. I'm the chair of the gallery and, as such, one of the organizers of Headland Sculpture on the Gulf. And I can tell, so I know a little bit about it. This year, 40,000 people visited Headland over 3 weeks. And sure, the port-a-loos were a bit smelly, but I think the island coped. And sure, there were queues at the ferries on some sunny days, but the island generally coped, and most businesses really liked it. And so if you were to spread 100,000 people realistically over 6 or 7 months, it would be probably, if you just start analyzing the figures, it doesn't seem that scary. Mm. Yeah.
Also, I think, it just seems to me that we're an island destination anyway. So the chances of people only coming for that are, I think people dissipate because they would come a part of their enjoyment. It wouldn't be the only thing that they'd be doing here. Yeah. They'd also be, going for a pizza or visiting Whakanefa going down the bottom end. They wouldn't all be just... And also, if 100,000 people came to the island, that would be a problem in itself.
Yeah.
Regardless of those particular beaches, that would just be a problem.
So I think you're right.
It's about managing tourism into the future.
And I think we've got enough sense to plan for that. Mm. There's also a price barrier. The comparison with Goat Island is, to get your family to Goat Island is $40 a petrol, Auckland suburb. To get a family of five from an Auckland suburb to Waiheke is a lot more than that. Mm. So,
can I just ask you one more question, which is around the success of the marine reserve that's already down the bottom end?
Te Matuku?
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Te Matuku is that it hasn't been very well monitored. It's been around for, correct me if I'm wrong, about 15 years, maybe. Yeah, that sort of. But because of the ongoing funding cuts to the Department of Conservation, they actually haven't had the money to monitor it closely. There's anecdotal evidence that there's lots of flounder in the bay and so on. And fishermen seem to think it's good because I've photographed people fishing in the reserve. They think it's good. But it hasn't been properly monitored, but it seems to be working. It's on the small side for a marine reserve, and it's also difficult to monitor because the water, as we all know, is a bit more murky on the south side. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's a functioning marine reserve. Mm. Yeah.
And as a boatie, and I assume a fisherman as well, do you have any thoughts around the fishing in the Gulf and commercial fishing in the Gulf?
Yeah.
How all that quota stuff?
Yeah, it's a very emotive issue and very much in the news at the moment, and in my presentations about the Marine Reserve, I do talk about snapper because they're an iconic, some say, keystone species in the Gulf. But when we're talking about marine reserves, we do want to focus on biodiversity rather than a single species. That said, the snapper issue, there are just a couple of things about the snapper issue that need to be highlighted. For the first time this year, we've got some fairly decent data about snapper population numbers and stuff. There was a proper scientific census of snapper in 2012, and that showed that the snapper population in the Hauraki Gulf is about 24% of unfished biomass. So if you could imagine all the fish that could be there without fishing, snapper as of 2012 in the Gulf apparently stand at about 24%. And this is a slow increase from about 10 to 12% of virgin biomass in the 1990s. The target for snapper in the Gulf is 40%, so we're halfway there. But there are some complicating factors. A lot of scientists consider the snapper population in the Gulf to be one and the same with the population in the Bay of Plenty, because they migrate around the top of the Coromandel. The 2012 census showed that the snapper population in the Bay of Plenty is 6% of virgin biomass, which is considered a collapsed stock.
Oh, really? That's really tragic. So essentially, we kind of do need to be thinking about places where fish stocks can be replenished.
Exactly.
And thinking about reducing fishing, especially commercial fishing.
Yeah, well, there's another something that people just need to know. In 2012, the recreational take of snapper in the Gulf exceeded that of commercial fishing. Yeah, the commercial fishing estimate was bumped up by 20% to allow for underreporting and losses. And the recreational take in its assessment was quite conservative because of concerns about the way the data was collected. But in the end, it turned out that recreational take in the Gulf was around 2,500 tons last year, and commercial take was about 2,400 tons last year.
Oh, really? So recreational fishing is actually a huge pressure on the Gulf?
In the inner Gulf, yeah. The commercial fishing is limited in the inner Gulf. There's only long lining allowed on the northern coast of Waiheke for 3 months of a year, and then the trawling and stuff only happens on a line beyond Little Barrier. Yeah.
Right.
But overall, yeah. So it really gets a bit complicated, as you can see. Yeah.
But really, in terms of what we're talking about, it's really important that everyone gets on the same page and uses their resources to think about how best we can get a marine reserve on the island.
Yes.
And so if people have spare resources, it would be really great if everyone works together to work out where that marine reserve can go.
Yeah, wouldn't it be lovely? Yeah, I think it's a matter of fairness. You know, New Zealanders are very strong on fairness. And with recreational fishermen, they at the moment have 99.7% of the Gulf to fish in. Take that to the land. Imagine if the local archery club expected 99.7% of the parks to go shoot kiriru with arrows. You know, it just wouldn't be the go. And so at sea, you know, if we just want a fair division, and the interesting thing is, if there's more marine reserves, the fishing will improve. That's been proven.
Yes. Yeah. Great. So huge benefits to marine reserves. We just need to work out where it needs to go.
Exactly, yeah.
And all get in behind the project and discuss the differences.
Yes, we should. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Great, great. Thank you very much, Alex,
thank
for
you.
Coming in. That was lovely. And that was Alex Stone talking about the marine reserve. What did you say? I shouldn't initiative, not
the
proposal.
Because
the other thing around it is it's not cast in stone. It's a discussion document.
That's right, yeah.
So, and how can people be part of the discussion?
The best is just to contact me or contribute to letters to the paper, for instance. We're involved in a process of talking to community groups. So far, I've talked to about 18 community groups on the island, and this takes a while. But if any group of any size, if it's 2 people, if it's 100 people, I will talk to them, talk with them, show what we're on about, and happy to. So right now, the last presentation I made was at the high school. On next Tuesday, I'm talking to the teachers at the primary school.
Oh, wow.
We're going to talk to the Probus Club and a fishing club. You know, they're just
great.
All of these presentations are part of a program. But if there's any group out there that wants to hear about it, give us a call.
Lovely. And there's also a Facebook page. If you're into Facebook,
I'm told
people
that,
use,
yeah, I
but
just,
you don't use
I just
it.
Learned this morning the Facebook page has been shut down. I don't know by who.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay.
But everyone knows how to contact me on the island, yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alex. Okay.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island, art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
Okay, well, here we are with John Stansfield, who's a trustee or chair of the board. Chair of the board of trustees at Waiheke High School. Hi, John.
Hey, Sharon. Thank you for having us on.
Great. So you're going to talk about the new principal and consultation around that.
Yep. Big year for the school. Neil Watson has left us and gone off to be the principal at a very large school, Otahuhu College. And the board's involved in a search process for a new principal. And the first part of that is to have some consultation with the whole of our community, teachers, students, parents and people who are not parents or maybe have decided to send their kids to another school, about what we want from a new principal. And so we're beginning that with a survey, which is up on SurveyMonkey, and you can access that from the school website, or you can go to the SurveyMonkey website, which is www.surveymonkey.com/s/principal, WHS, all in caps.
Lovely. And if you WHS. Go to the Waiheke High School site, it'll
there's
be
a link.
Clear?
There's a link
there. Okay, so that might be easy
yep,
as well.
Yep, that might be easy. As well as that, we're going to have some public consultations. We've got a consultation with students on this Wednesday coming at 3:15, and then on the same day, this Wednesday coming at 7 at night in the school hall, we'll be hosting a consultation with parents and members of the public, and we'll do that sort of semi-cafe style and try and gather all those views up.
So what time is that? 7?
It's 7 o'clock this Wednesday coming.
Lovely.
And all of that and the survey data will then get pulled together and the board will have a meeting on the following Tuesday and then rock, we're off.
Great. So that's to establish the kinds of things that people want from their principal. And you haven't actually started applying for a new principal because you're waiting for this data to come
in. That's correct.
Right. Okay, lovely. And are there any initial findings that you can talk about? Or
well, it's,
that
it's no, not initial before? Findings, but it's a very big job this time. A considerable amount of our school and almost all of Te Huruhi are going to have to be rebuilt as a result of new earthquake standards, and that's taking up a fairly large amount of time for the board, or well, some members of the board, myself included, and Tony Sears, who's the acting principal at the moment. So it's a pretty big year, and I hope that the consultation that we're doing now is really just the beginning of a broader consultation with the community about the direction that the school takes and the kind of pedagogy it adopts. And also hope that we have a lot of the community involved in the design of our new school.
Mm. Is that a new? Is that something new? This notion of consulting the community before you put out, a request for a principal.
Well, typically we consult around things like the strategic plan for the school, but the board decided that it's a good chance to kind of refresh the vision of the school. So the consultation is around the school vision and then looking at that, you know, is that the vision you want? And does that get you the kind of, or what kind of principal would get us to that place?
Right. Lovely. Good. And anything else happening at the school? I mean, it seems like a lot.
The school's really buzzy, actually. I went to the Board Education Committee this week and I had three great presentations by very passionate teachers who are really excited about the work they're doing. The school has, of course, been improving its academic outputs year on year and is actually performing very well. I think we were remarking the other day that it is actually a much safer school than it was 5 years ago. Discipline incidents are right down. It's a safe, healthy, good learning environment. Great. And we want to work with the community to make that better still.
Lovely. Okay, well, thanks very much. Right, well, that was John Stansfield, Chair of the Board of Trustees at Waiheke High School, talking about the consultation process for the hiring of the new principal. And just to remind you, there is a meeting at 7 o'clock on Wednesday at the school, if you want to be involved in talking about that. But also, it's up on Survey Monkey, or you can find the high school website, and there's a link to a survey that you can fill out. So, lovely. Thank you. Oh, already gone. Okay, see ya.
Thank you.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 1.